Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 6th of January 2023 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. This is the first Patriotic History of the new year. We've actually been going for over a year now with a series. We started off with Patriarch as co-host and now we also have Truthids as a co-host and we are going to be looking at the Saxon era today. We started off looking at the Welsh, looking at the Britons, and we then went through the Romans and then we went through these battles between the Saxons and the Britons, and now we're going to be concentrating on the Saxons, particularly for this episode. We might also look at what was going on in Gaul. But first off, I will introduce my co-hosts. Truthids, a happy new year. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Hello, Sven. Thanks for having me back. Yeah, all good. Looking forward to a new year of patriotic history, right?
Excellent, excellent. It is such fun studying our history and learning about it, our British history and also our European history. Patriarch, happy new year. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Happy new year, Sven. Yeah, I'm very well, thanks. Rested and that after Christmas and ready to get to being productive and doing something again.
Yeah, this is actually pre-recorded and it's the first podcast that I've recorded of the new year. Hopefully we won't be too rusty and we'll be able to get straight back into it. So we're now looking at around about the 8th century. So we are still taking our notes from R.W. Morgan here and his History of the Cymry. From AD 730 to 1066, there is little to be chronicled, but a wearisome sameness of unavailing battles and exhibitions of barbarism. Of the country afterwards called England, Britons, Saxons, Angles, Jutes, Vandals, and other nondescript tribes constituted the population, all distinct characteristics of race, language, and nationality being now lost in a common hybridism. West of the Severn, the eldest tribe of the Cymry held their hereditary domains untouched, cherishing an inextinguishable animosity against the Saxon and Saxonized tribes eastwards, and watching every opportunity that promised them a chance, however remote, of recovering the British sceptre, now by the conquest or defection of their sister tribes, passed from their hands. And I'll just stop there because the point of this is when he says all distinct characteristics of race, he actually means nation, because at this time when you were talking about races, you would talk about the English race, the Welsh race, the French race. And because these Saxons and Vandals and Angles had actually been in Britain for about 200 years by this point, and since it was only really the language that separated them, now they're all speaking the same language, they were also all Christian, and that is the main aspects of ethnicity, is shared religion, shared language, shared ancestry. And if we go a little bit further back, if we go back about 1,000 years, these were all essentially the same people. The Cymry were the same people as the Scythians, and it was only over time that the Cymrians became known as the Cymry and the Scythians became known as the Saxons. So when it's talking about a common hybridism here, it's not talking about a hybrid between, say, Europeans and Black Africans. It's talking about a hybridism between European nationalities to create another one, which is kind of like what would have happened with America. If they hadn't have had black slaves there, America would have turned into a new European nation, basically, and that was the way that it was going until they accepted citizens of all different races, because this is what happens when you end up with other European nations or other European tribes coming into one country. They eventually become the same people, and I think we can see the same happening today. I think we've got quite a few Polish that are now within Britain, and I can see within a couple of generations they would have completely assimilated and they will be no different to the other indigenous British people. Truthids, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, with America originally, there was great differences between the states, right? And they considered themselves separate people, and people even remembered their ancestry, that they were, from this part of England or that part of Scotland or you know, they were part this, part that, but now they just consider themselves all American, and that's basically what happened to England, right? But I find it interesting that the guy who wrote this, he doesn't consider Alfred the Great worthy of mention. It's just all mindless battles to him. You can see he's slightly biased, but you know that's fine. That's just the way it is. And then the other thing is, it's interesting that the Welsh, the main tribe was the Cymry, right? Not the Trojans or not the people from Brutus, even though, you know, they'd intermixed, that the Cymry was the dominant tribe, right? That's interesting, because they were part of the Germanic tribes as well, even though they probably didn't really fully realize this, right?
Yeah, they didn't understand this. I mean, we only understand this looking back through the histories. But Patriarch, any thoughts on this at all?
Yeah, like you say, it's obviously quite normal for different tribes to branch off and easily kind of assimilate again. I was just wondering then, at this point when there was that kind of full-on amalgamated hybridism, would that be when the coin Anglo-Saxon was coined, essentially?
Yeah, I should imagine it was. And just to pick up on the point there that you made, Truthfids, about R.W. Morgan, who is writing this, and he is obviously biased towards the Welsh, but it is a patriotic history. And all the histories that were written 100 years ago, 150 years ago, they all had this strong strain of patriotism all the way through them. In fact, I think anything that was written 150 years ago will reflect patriotism, because everybody was a patriot. They understood that they were a part of this extended family, and they were competing against these other extended families around the world. And we understood that the other races were completely different peoples to us. We were competing against other Europeans. We weren't competing against black Africans. We weren't competing against Indians. You know, they were at a different stage in civilization. Their civilizations were not as advanced as ours. So we weren't really competing against them. It was just seen as competing amongst other European nations, competing against the French, competing against the Germans. Of course, unfortunately, that led to the First and the Second World War, when we saw that Germany economically was going to become a competitor to Britain. So that was the cause of these wars, unfortunately. It's much better that we actually see ourselves as all being together, all part of an extended family. And the fact that the Saxons, Angles, Jutes and Vandals could come to Britain and within a couple of generations be indistinguishable from the British. And that's just the proof of it, that we are all an extended family as white people. Well, this isolation compelled them to reorganise their constitution on a miniature scale in imitation of their old empire. And that's the Cymry here. Instead of Logria, Cambria and Albion, and there is still a sign when you actually go into England from Wales that says Logria, because that was the old name for England. Instead of Logria, Cambria and Albion, they divided their patrimony into Vinedotia, which is Gwynedd, Powys and a Hubarth, which is Pembrokeshire. This last one comprising Gwent, Morgannwg and Dyfed. The princes of Powys, Gwent, Dyfed and Morgannwg were subordinated to the prince of Vinedotia as the lord of all Cambria and representative of the once imperial dynasty of Britain. To his custody were consigned with religious care until they should again adorn the person of a sovereign of the Trojan race of Brutus, the regalia of Constantine the Great, of Arthur and of Cadwallo, all these famous kings that were all a part of the Welsh race. I mean, we've all heard of Constantine the Great, and a lot of people think that he was just this Roman. They don't realise that he was also a British king. And we've looked at the two Arthurs, and of course, a lot of people think that Arthur is just comes from myth. And he wasn't. He was Welsh. I think the Cornish also lay claim to him. But there's lots of evidence to show that he did exist and he was Welsh. And then we have Cadwallo, who we learned about in the last episode, that was defeat in the Saxons. So basically, what we have here is, because the Cymry no longer have the whole island, they're now just in Wales. So they basically have the same constitution, but they miniaturise it so that it just takes in Wales, and they have basically three parts to Wales, just like there were three parts to Britain when they were ruling Britain. So, and the Pendragon, or the king that was over the lot of them, was this Venedotian king from Gwynedd. Any thoughts on this, Truefitz?
Yeah, they just had to adapt, right, and await, and it did actually happen, right? It wasn't just, it never came to be. That was Henry the VII, who put his son Henry the VIII on the throne, and he actually became king of the whole island again, right? And he wasn't necessarily the greatest king, but he did spawn, you know, Elizabeth and other, you know, kings and queens. So it did happen eventually, right?
Yeah, and I think also, I mean, it says here about the regalia of Constantine the Great, of Arthur and of Cadwallo, and I think, you know, a lot of that regalia actually got lost, and it got hidden and it got secreted away, and you know, parts of it are probably still existing somewhere in Wales, you know, buried somewhere. That's one of these sad things, you know, the sword of Constantine the Great, you know, things that belong to Arthur. We know about the cross that St. Helen of the Cross brought back from Jerusalem, and that's supposedly still in Wales. All sorts of things that we hear about in the past that were owned by these monarchs that have just disappeared today, unfortunately. Patriarch, any views on this?
I'm just looking at a map, actually, of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms and sort of the Welsh kingdoms, and it's not too far from kind of what we have today. Obviously, we've expanded more. So we've got Cornwall now, which is pretty much part of England, and a portion of Northumbria has kind of been given up to Scotland. But generally, a lot of the boundaries of Anglo-Saxon kingdoms have kind of remained the same to this day.
Yeah, and we got the Picts that were up there in the north as well, and Cornwall was still seen as part of this kingdom, and Brittany as well was still a part of it. That's why the Breton language, the Cornish language, and the Welsh language, they're all extremely similar. The ancient usages prescribed the payment by Cambria for the military defence of the island to the king in London, whoever it might be, of a certain sum of gold called the Temeged, the king tax. And this, the Cambrian princes never appear under any circumstances to have shown any disposition to withhold. In all other respects, they resisted the imposition of foreign laws upon their subjects and foreign encroachments upon their beautiful but limited territories with the same dauntless and indepressible spirit that had marked their ancestors of the Roman and Arthurian periods. So that's interesting. Even though they weren't on such good terms with the Saxons, they still paid the tax for the defence of the island to the king in London. So that means that it was still seen that if anyone attacked the island, then they would all fight together against whoever it was, despite the fact that they were having these internal squabbles between them. Because this was their law, whoever was the king in London, he was responsible for this military defence of the island, so that they continued to pay it. So that's interesting. Any thoughts on that, Truefitz?
I wasn't aware of that. So I guess because the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms kind of, the power shifted constantly, and especially with the Danish invasions, then whoever owned London would be shifting, right? And eventually Wessex, ended up the dominant force. So the tax must have went to them. I do recall that with Alfred the Great in Sharon Turner's book, he wrote that the Welsh kings acknowledged him as the superior of the island. So by then, you know, that was when... So there must have been some acknowledgement of the dominion, but although they wanted to remain independent and have their own laws, and that seems to have been the case, right, until the Normans came, right?
Yeah, that seems to have been a tradition that they had from the Romans as well. I mean, they paid the Romans an amount of money, and the Romans were responsible for the defence of the island, which was mainly made up of the British army. It was Britons that made up the majority of the Roman army at certain times. And again, part of the treaty was that they could follow their own laws in Britain. And I think that was the only treaty out of all the Roman Empire that said that they could retain their kings and retain their laws, which is, another credit to our ancestors here in Britain. Patriarch, any thoughts on this tax payment or any other elements of this?
Yeah, I think it shows an understanding, you know, of who has rights to the land, and that they do have common ground. It's almost like a nation, especially an island like that. It's almost like a ship, isn't it? You know, there might be some internal conflicts, but ultimately they know who the ship belongs to, and there's a common kind of just common ground, and there's no room for outsiders to have their input or say. So in terms of, you know, established boundaries were already there, so they know that paying into a common defense is good for, you know, all the inhabitants of the island.
Yeah, the Saxons must have been completely separated from the Saxon Confederation on the continent now as well. And there'd also been these intermarriages right from the start. There had been intermarriages between the Welsh kings and the Saxon kings. Well, it would neither interest nor instruct the reader to dwell on the gloomy details of these night centuries of the useless and interminable battles which continued between the Cymry and the Anglo-Britons, or Saxons. The following are enumerated simply because they may serve as chronological landmarks in the monotonous wild of darkness, superstition, cruelty, and mutual carnage we are now traversing. Frodri Molwynog succeeded Idwal the Roe, AD 720. He defeated Ethelard, the successor of Ivor in the West Saxon Kingdom, at Helin in Cornwall, AD 728, again at Garth Melog in Vinadotia, AD 729, and a third time at Pennycoed Glamorgan, AD 730. And in France, Charles Martel defeated the Arabs, AD 732, at the Battle of Tours, and saved the continent from being Mahometanized. And that was the word that they actually used for Islam and Muslims. They called them Mohammedans, or Mahometans, actually spelt with a T. So that was the way that Muslims were thought of back when this was written, which was probably about 140 years ago now. So we will we'll move on from Britain now to take a look at what was happening in the continent. But first off, I'll pass it over to Truthfeeds to tell us what you know about Charles Martel and about this this period here, Truthfeeds.
Yeah, so Clovis, of course, was the first Frankish king, and he gradually expanded and took you know, all of what we'd call France and kind of made it one kingdom. And he left it to his sons. But back then, they didn't just have, you know, the eldest becomes the king. Rather, they kept dividing it amongst, you know, so if he had four sons, you'd try and split the entire country to four. That was how they did it back then. And eventually that was removed because obviously it's a policy that's going to fail, because you'll keep dividing it and dividing it and dividing it, you know, amongst, you know, your descendants, and they'll get weaker and weaker and all squabble and fight amongst themselves. And then a foreign force will just come in and take it all. So it's far better to just have one almighty king that can defend the realm, right? And at this time, Clovis's dynasty had really weakened. I think they had just been reduced to only having like cities by then. That's how much it had fragmented. And Charles Martel, he was the not prime minister, but kind of the defender of the realm. And then his son got rid of the Clovis dynasty and just made himself basically king. And then you get Charlemagne after that. So Charlemagne's actually descended from Charles Martel. And I think Charles Martel, his father was actually maybe a priest. I'd have to double check, but they did. Charlemagne claimed descent from the Trojans as well, right? Through, because his line, he wasn't actually a Frank. He was actually from the center line. And a lot of the centers converted to priests, you know, the original Romans, because that's how they could maintain power. So he claimed through that branch that he was descended from the Trojans, which is interesting, right? Always that wanting to have that link to the Trojans, right? Or Odin from the Saxon perspective and, you know, Germanic tribes, right?
Well, you've got to have a reason for, you know, why you are a noble, why you are part of the aristocracy. And they could show that by these family trees that they had. He was Charles the Hammer, Martel, because he was well known for this defence of France, this defence of the whole of Europe, really, against this huge Muslim army that we'll get into. But I think also what you were saying there, Truefids, I mean, that highlights why this equality doctrine is no good, because they had the same problem in Wales. You know, when the king would die, you would have all these princes, and they would often get given a part. And it was the same with the sons of families as well. When the head of the family died, everything would be split up between the number of sons that he had. And in that way, these fortunes would become more and more and more diminished. So, when you look at it that way, that's why they used to say it's the eldest son that gets everything, the eldest son. Otherwise, it just gets split up and lost. And of course, now they would say, well, you know, that's not fair. It should go to all the others. What about the sisters? It should go to the sisters. But that way, these fortunes just get diminished until there's nothing left of them. That's why, you know, the law of primogeniture, I think it's called, the law of the eldest son being the one that gets everything, it's so that everything wasn't lost. I mean, it makes sense when you look at it like that. And that's why they had this law in the Bible, that everything goes to the firstborn eldest son. He's the most important one. Because otherwise, you just lose your fortune. And there we see that playing out in Gaul at this time, when the Merovingian kings, or the ones descended from Clovis, they ended up just getting smaller and smaller and smaller regions, until they practically lost it all. I mean, it's tragic, really, but that's where the doctrine of equality leads to. Patriarch, any thoughts on this, or the Battle of Tours, Charles Martel? I'm sure you must have heard of him before.
Yes, it's interesting. What picked my ears up was just the notion of, you know, everything going to the firstborn, and it does just completely make sense. Like you say, a concentration of power leaves the offspring in the best chance to, you know, carry the flag for the kingdom. And I think that's echoed throughout scriptures as well, isn't it, with, you know, a chosen people. And even if you want to touch on the whole firstborn thing, firstborn child, you know, the blessing was promised through a certain lineage. So the firstborn of Abraham wasn't necessarily under the promise. It was the firstborn with Hagar as promised by God. So you know, firstborn and blessings kind of, they follow a definitive pattern, don't they?
Yeah, and also, I mean, you may have been thinking there of Sarah. Hagar was the one. I mean,
Hagar was with the firstborn of Abraham.
Servant woman, yeah. But she was the servant woman rather than the actual wife, which was Sarah. So the firstborn of the actual wife, Sarah, was the important one. But another point of this is because when you get these other sons and they haven't actually been left anything, so that means they've got to go out and conquer new lands so that they've got something to give to their firstborn. So it also spurred white people on to go out and discover new lands and to tame the wilderness so that they had something that they could give to their sons. And also, when we got a little bit further in, one of the sons would be given to the church as well. You'd have one that would receive everything, one that would be given to the church, sworn to the church from childhood, and then the rest of them would have to go out and find somewhere else to set up their own kingdom, and it served to help white people spread all out across the world. I mean, that same sort of thing is probably what led to the Saxons coming over into Britain as well. Because if you're not going to be left everything that your father has, you have to go out and create that for yourself, and then what you've created goes to your firstborn. And if there isn't any room to do that in the island that you live on, or the part of the continent that you live on, then you have to go out and discover somewhere else. And of course, that led to lots of people going off to the new world. Well, let's concentrate now on the Battle of Tours, and we'll move to Wikipedia for our notes here. The Battle of Tours followed two decades of Umayyad conquests in Europe, which had begun with the invasion of the Christian Visigothic kingdom of the Iberian Peninsula in 711, and that's Spain. These were followed by military expeditions into the Frankish territories of Gaul, former provinces of the Roman Empire. Umayyad military campaigns reached northwards into Aquitaine and Burgundy, including a major engagement at Bordeaux and a raid on Autun. Charles' victory is widely believed to have stopped the northwards advance of the Umayyad forces from the Iberian Peninsula and to have prevented the Islamization of Western Europe. And this is quite interesting because you think Muhammad, I think, was around about 600 AD. And within 100 years, these Arabs and the followers of Muhammad have just, they've just been this military force that have invaded all these countries, and they've managed to make their way into Spain, and they've literally taken over Spain, and they've got the whole of Spain. And before that, it was the Visigoths. And I mean, the Visigoths were, you know, they were a powerful group of people. You know, they were very, very powerful militarily. And yet these Muslims, the Mohammedans, have managed to take over, and they're running the place. Literally, just within 100 years of Muhammad's birth, you know, that is quite a feat when you think about it. Any thoughts on this, Truthvids, and the Muhammadan conquest of Spain?
Yeah, so this all kickstarted when the Byzantine Empire became Christian, and you know, most of Europe, because it resulted in you know, if you didn't convert to Christianity, then basically you were kicked out, right? And the Jews never accepted Christianity, so they could either stay, but they were never allowed to be able to hold positions, or you know, their freedom was greatly diminished unless they were willing to convert, and they weren't. So a lot of them went out into the East, and they invented this religion where they plagiarized a lot of the Bible, and they convinced the Arabs that they were descended from Ishmael. And basically it militarized them all, and they created this great force. And that's how they were able to invade, because they had the entire resources of the East. I mean, Spain was being overrun, but Spain was only, you know, the tribe of the Visigoths, right? But they were against the entire East, so they were massively outnumbered. And at the same time, there are reports by the later Spanish kingdom, they accused the Jews of assisting the Arabs, because some of them were allowed to come in and trade, and they knew what was going on in the Visigothic kingdoms, you know, where they were strong, where they were weak, if there was a weakness. So they were able to relay the intelligence and aid these Muslim conquests. And back to Charles Martel, interestingly, because he wasn't the king, he didn't have you know, enormous resources or money. He actually had to go and raid the churches of all their money, and so he could fund an army and put together some kind of resistance. And he got a lot of flack from that, from the Catholic churches. So you can see at that time the Catholic churches didn't really take this invasion seriously, and they were more concerned with their wealth, whilst Charles was wise enough to realize, no, we've got to stop this. If not, you know, we're going to get overrun. So Charles Martel does deserve a lot of credit for that, right, Sven?
Definitely. You know, and I think some people might say, well, what's this link between the Jews and the Muslims and setting up Islam? But Muhammad, apparently his mother was Jewish, which meant that he was Jewish. And then you've got the fact that Arabs and Jews are both Semites. And at this time, what you've got is the Sephardic Jews, or the Spanish Jews, which are not Khazarian or Ashkenazi Jews. They are very, very close to the Arabs. And of course, they're both considered Semitic-speaking people, so they're both referred to as Semites. So there was a natural ethnic solidarity between Jews and Muslims at this time, or between Jews and Arabs at this time. And when you look in history, if you look up the Jewish Golden Age, which was basically when Spain was held by the Muslims, because the Jews were given these important positions as bankers, as overlords of the people, basically. And they considered it to be a golden age. And the Europeans were forced to the north of Spain, where they then had to fight to try and take the country back, which I think took them a couple of hundred years up to the time of Isabel. But all during that time, when Spain was in the hands, or southern Spain was in the hands of the Muslims, you know, the Jews held a privileged position. And in their histories, they talk about it being the golden age. And then when the Muslims were finally kicked out of Spain, then the Spaniards then held those Jews responsible, the ones that were there, they held them responsible for the fact that Spain was invaded by these Muslims in the first place. I mean, you can read all this on Wikipedia. This isn't anti-Semitism. We're just talking about history here. And I think, you know, what you have to bear in mind is there's this close solidarity between Jews and Muslims because they had the same ancestry, and the Jews considered this a wonderful time. It was a golden age for them, but of course it was the dark ages for the Spanish, because the Spanish Christians had actually lost their lands. And then when they finally removed the Muslims, they then had this problem with the Jews there, and a lot of the Jews then converted to Christianity. But they hadn't actually converted to Christianity. They just paid lip service to it. And that's when you got the Spanish Inquisition, which was to find out who were the Jews that had sincerely converted to Christianity and who were the Jews that were still following their Jewish traditions. And the ones that were still following their Jewish traditions, they were then expelled from the country. And at this time in Britain, we didn't actually have any Jews in Britain at this time. But they did exist at this part of Spain here. Patriarch, any thoughts on all of this?
In terms of the wealth of the general Jews, I mean, they'd always been involved with trade routes and commerce, hadn't they? I mean, even they must have amassed a lot of wealth from the Khazarian Empire, right? And kind of that would have had a continued sort of control or connections throughout parts of Europe.
Yeah, they certainly had a lot of gold. I mean, they were always known as money lenders. I mean, they were money lenders, and they played an important part in the banking system in the Roman Empire. And obviously they must have also done out there where the Muslims were. In those areas, and I think they were expelled from the Byzantine Empire, or in the Byzantine Empire they couldn't hold political positions, they couldn't teach, they couldn't have Christian slaves. I mean, the church brought in all these laws basically to keep Jews separate. I mean, they said, well, we don't mind Jews living in our countries, we want to use them as an example of what has happened to the people that reject God, so we don't mind having them in our countries, but we have to have laws to keep them separate from the Christians, and we have to have laws to protect Christians from usury and things like that. And that led to the Jews, or a lot of Jews, leaving the Byzantine Empire, moving into Khazaria. And then you get the Khazars that convert. And some people say today, oh, well, that's just a myth. But it's all talked about in the Orthodox Church histories, in the Russian Church histories. They talk about this Khazarian Empire that then became Jewish, and they, as you say, they were a patriarch. They would have amassed a lot of money there, and then they moved into Poland. And by that time, they were Khazars or Ashkenazi. They started off as Sephardim, which I think goes back to Sepharvaim. If you look in the Old Testament, they talk of a group of Jews called the Sepharvaim. And that's not Israelites. That's not from the tribe of Judah. But there's this group called the Sepharvaim, and they moved into the land that was held by Israel when the Israelites were removed from that country. So I think that's where you get this term Sephardic from. And then when the Byzantine Empire made these laws that prevented them from being able to operate in the way that they wanted to, then a lot of them moved into Khazaria. Then they converted the king. And that's an interesting part to this as well. I mean, one of the allegations made against the Jews by the Romans was that they were proselytizing. They were trying to turn people into Jews, basically. And this was before the advent of Christianity. And you also had, actually in Judea, you had proselytes of the gate, proselytes of justice, were people that the Jews had managed to convince to join their Jewish religion, to get circumcised and to join their Jewish religion, which is very different to today, when they say, you know, they try to dissuade people from converting to Judaism and it's all hereditary. But that wasn't always so. I mean, at the time before Christ, there was lots and lots of attempts to convert people to Judaism, and there was obviously at the time of Khazaria. And I'll just hand it back to Truefords, because I know he knows a fair bit about this point in history as well. Do you want to pick up on any of those bits there, Truefords?
Yeah, that's why, you know, Christ said, when you convert them, you make them twice the children of hell, that, you know, they were rejecting Christianity at that point. At the same time, they were trying to convert other people to their religion, right? And yeah, so basically when the Jews were kicked out, some went to Arabia and some went up to Caesarea, right? And that's where they also collected all their writings and formed the Talmud. And up in Caesarea, they gradually converted the people there. They were probably a Japhethite kingdom, because when the Scythians came over, they also forcefully brought over some of the Assyrians and the Medes. And some of them were left there, so there would have been Israelites, but it wasn't, you know, a completely Israelite kingdom. And that's probably why they were more easily swayed to go away from Christianity and accept Judaism, and they intermixed. And that's eventually from there where they were able to convert the Turks who were coming over from the east also to Islam, convince them to become Islamic, and convince them to invade the Byzantine Empire, right, from the east.
That's interesting, isn't it? So you had a group that were in Arabia, and they end up formulating Islam with Muhammad, and then you have another group that end up with the Khazars and converting them, and then you get Ashkenazi Jewry from there that then makes its way into Europe. I mean, a lot of this history, when you look at Christian history, a lot of the what happened with the Jews is kept out of it. You know, like when you get to the Protestant revolution, they'll talk about the Protestants and they'll talk about the Catholics, but the official histories don't really talk about the Jews and their role that they actually played in all of this. What they were doing there, they owned a lot of the printing presses, so they were printing a lot of the Bibles, these new Protestant Bibles, and generally trying to create a conflict between the Protestants and the Catholics, because they would benefit from that. And also here you've got this bit here where they end up being involved in the starting of Mohammedanism, the starting of Islam, and then they have these good relationships with these Muslims that are coming over to Spain. They aided them to come into Spain. And then they were rewarded for that. And that was when they had their golden age, was with the Muslims, when the Muslims were ruling Spain. Moving from there back to Wikipedia and the Battle of Tours, most historians assume that the two armies met where the rivers Clain and Vienne join between Tours and Poitiers. The number of troops in each army is not known. The Mozarabic Chronicle of 754, a Latin contemporary source which describes the battle in greater detail than any other Latin or Arabic source, states that the people of Austrasia, the Frankish forces, greater in number of soldiers and formidably armed, killed the king Abdurrahman, which agrees with many Arab and Muslim historians. However, virtually all Western sources disagree, estimating the Franks as numbering 30,000, less than half the Muslim force. So Wikipedia is trying to say that the Franks actually had more than the Muslims, but all the Western sources say that the Franks had half the number of the Muslims. And we do have Latin and Arabic sources for this. Some modern historians, using estimates of what the land was able to support and what Martel could have raised from his realm and supported during the campaign, believe the total Muslim force, counting the outlying raiding parties which rejoined the main body before Tours, outnumbered the Franks. Drawing on non-contemporary Muslim sources, Creasy describes the Umayyad forces as 80,000 strong or more. Writing in 1999, Paul K. Davis estimates the Umayyad forces at 80,000 and the Franks at about 30,000, while noting that modern historians have estimated the strength of the Umayyad army at Tours at between 20 to 80,000. So it may have been that the reinforcements is what made up the 80,000. But it does seem to me as if the Franks had a much smaller army, especially if, as you were saying, Truthvids, this was the whole of the East that they had amassed to come into Spain and were then working their way into Europe to conquer Europe, it's quite feasible that they would have had 80,000 of them. Any thoughts on this, Truefids?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, they would have had a massive force, right? I mean, if you look just at the size of the East and all the former land, you know, Assyria, Medes, Persia, Arabia, Egypt, you know, they could easily amass a massive amount of people, and they weren't necessarily, you know, all equipped with professional weapons. Some, it was just getting sheer numbers and just launching raids, right, overwhelming places. Whilst the Franks were relatively small at the time, and Charles Martel just got together whatever he could, right?
I also think a point to make here as well is that the Arabs, they weren't as dark as they are today either. You know, that took place with the black African slave trade and interbreeding with them. I think at this point they were still fairly light skinned as well. When you look at the paintings that were done of the Moors, which we talked about in our last episode, in the 12th and the 13th century, you know, a lot of them are very white looking, and occasionally there's the odd darker one. So I think at this time, you know, this force were much fairer. They had much fairer skin than Arabs actually do today. Any thoughts on these numbers here, Patriarch?
Yeah, I mean, it shows that they had a clear agenda, doesn't it? To amass such a force, they and it was, you know, it obviously took the power of a religious unification and essentially the early Islamic doctrines that essentially Christianity isn't exactly how they think it is. They believe it to be something different. They still teach the same things of you know, Rome distorting the true message of God and everything. So, you know, it was essentially a holy war for them, wasn't it? And they knew exactly who they had to attack in order to do that, because you know, the Christians actually had the had Christ, and it was it's essentially Antichrist movement.
Yeah, it was all about conquest. It was all about trying to take over Europe. I mean, that's the difference between Islam and Christianity. With Christianity, they try to educate people so that of their own free will, they will become Christians from understanding the way that the world is. Whereas Islam is about forcing the world to adhere to Sharia law, and then they will become Muslim. And if they're not Muslim, then they'll have to pay a jizya tax. And their women can be raped, and that encourages people to become Muslims, but it may not be of their own free will that they become Muslims. I mean, that's the essential difference between Islam and Christianity. And I think the mistake that we make as Christians is that we assume that all other religions are the same as Christianity, and they want people to come of their own free will to make a decision to become a part of that religion. And that just isn't so. You know, that's projecting Christianity onto Islam, which is very different. And you could say that it reflects the people, the Arab people. They need to have a very strong law. They need to be ruled with an iron fist, basically. They need to have these very, very strict punishments. And it works. You know, if you go to an Islamic country, there won't be any robbery there. There won't be any street robbery. There won't be any muggings. You know, shops will be able to put stuff out and stuff won't get stolen because you get your hands chopped off, you know, if you steal. So it does work. Whereas with Christianity that's developed with European people, you know, we can have these lighter punishments. We don't chop people's hands off. And before we had multiculturalism, you know, we did have countries that you could put stuff out and you could leave your door open and, you know, leave your door unlocked rather, and you wouldn't get robbed or anything like that. It's only with the loss of Christianity and the importation of different people, so we have multiculturalism, obviously carried out by our governments, you know, that's the reason why we've had this increase in lack of trust. You know, we can't trust our communities as much as we used to, because the community has been divided. And again, that goes back to another Christian proverb, doesn't it? A house divided against itself will not stand. Getting back to the notes here, losses during the battle are unknown, But chroniclers later claimed that Charles Martel's force lost about 1,500, while the Umayyad force was said to have suffered massive casualties of up to 375,000 men. However, these same casualty figures were recorded in the Liber Pontificalis for Duke Odo the Great's victory at the Battle of Toulouse in 721, and we'll have a look at that as well. Paul the Deacon reported correctly in his History of the Lombards, written around 785, that the Liber Pontificalis mentioned these casualty figures in relation to Odo's victory at Toulouse, although he claimed that Charles Martel fought in this battle alongside Odo. But later writers, probably influenced by the continuations of Fridigar, attributed the Muslim casualties solely to Charles Martel, and the battle in which they fell became unequivocally that of Tours and Poitiers. The Viti Pardolfi, written in the middle of the 8th century, reports that after the battle, Abdul Rahman's forces burned and looted their way through the Limousine on their way back to Al-Andalus, which implies that they were not destroyed to the extent imagined in the continuations of Fridigar. So there may have been some exaggeration that was put in here. I would say there's definitely some exaggeration when they're saying that the Umayyad forces probably numbered about 80,000, and yet you've got this record that says they suffered massive casualties of up to 375,000 men. I mean, that's definitely an exaggeration. And what he's saying here is these two battles, because there was also Odo the Great's battle, and also then you have Charles Martel's battle, and the two seem to have got like mixed together in the history here. Any thoughts on that, Truefids?
Usually when the Arabs would invade it, they would send out raiding parties, apart from the main army, and they would just go and burn villages and cause terror and fear to try and just make everybody run away, to give them a better chance in the army. They wanted to create that terror. So even if they lost a massive amount in the main battle, there still would be, these raiders roaming around who could still cause terror when they fled. But as for Charles Martel's battle, he was a lot more grounded. He didn't try and take them on, in an open battle. Rather, he stayed by a tree line and had primarily his troops were on the ground. So they had this shield behind him. So if anything went wrong, he could retreat into the trees and he couldn't get overrun by cavalry. And he had a very clever tactic that he hid some horsemen. And as the battle took part, he sent those horsemen round to the Arabs' camps where they had massed massive amount of loot, and they started burning the camp. And this caused half of the Arabs to realize that their loot was getting burnt, and they fled the battle to go and protect their loot. And that caused the battle lines of the Arab force to start breaking. And then Charles Martel was able to crush them, and then eventually, chase them down and drive them out of the country. So Charles Martel was a great commander when you look at his strategy, right?
Yeah, that's an amazing strategizing there. And I just find it interesting here that these Muslim forces, they're burning and looting. They've got no desire to, take over that area or to do something with it. They just want to burn and loot. They just want to destroy everything, on their way back through, which I guess it's similar to the Danes. I mean, they just burned and destroyed things, apparently, when they came into Britain. That was the sad thing about it. They destroyed a lot of monasteries and a lot of scrolls. But you got the same thing going on here with these Muslims just burning and looting everything as they made their way through France. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Were there any what other wars were going off at the time, like with regards to the Middle East, for example? Obviously, that was the regarded as the Holy Land. What was actually going off around the Levant region at that time? Was that fully consumed now by the Mohammedites and the Arabs?
No, I think that was holding out, wasn't it? Because it wasn't until the Crusades, the 10th and the 11th century, that looked like it was going to fall, and that was when. Obviously, you had these armies that came in from Europe. And I mean, I'm not exactly certain of the bits that were actually held by by the Muslims at that point, but I do know that Jerusalem was still held by the Orthodox Church, for instance. Trifids, do you know anything about this time?
Yeah, the East Roman Empire Byzantine was still very strong at that time. They had a proper military force, so they could withstand all this. It was the Visigoths who were, they were actually infighting a lot, and because they could never get everyone to accept one king, and that's what made them so weak. And also the Byzantines, where they'd put those laws in, they'd kicked out all the Jews, whilst the Visigoths hadn't. So they were very divided, and they had people in there who were relaying information to the Arab conquests. And then when these invaded, a lot of the Visigoths actually just converted to Muslims, or a few of the nobles, because they were promised, look, if you convert, you can keep your land and all that. And they weren't really hardcore Christians at that point. I believe a lot of them were still Aryan Christians. So they just said, yeah, sure. So that's why it all collapsed, right?
Yeah, that also highlights this bit that, Islam doesn't mind if you convert at the point of a sword. They're saying, well, you can keep your wealth if you also become a Muslim, although it's at the point of a sword. And you wouldn't get that with Christianity. The way with Christianity was to educate the population so that they would want to become Christians, because they would understand, the natural world around them and the truth behind Christianity. I mean, that was the origin of Sunday schools and trying to educate the population, and the sponsoring of science and all these sorts of things. Whereas what you had with the Islamic Empire was, let's get all our weapons and we'll go out conquering. A totally different mindset from these religions. Well, just to talk a little bit about the Umayyads, which was the dynasty that was ruling in Spain. The invasion of Hispania and then Gaul was led by the Umayyad dynasty, the first dynasty of Sunni caliphs of the Sunni Islamic Empire after the reign of the Rashidun caliphs, which was Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman and Ali, had ended. The Umayyad Caliphate, at the time of the Battle of Tours, was perhaps the world's foremost military power. The great expansion of the Caliphate occurred under the reign of the Umayyads. Muslim armies pushed east across Persia and west across North Africa through the late 7th century. So that's when they would have taken Ethiopia, I guess. They would have taken Egypt. That was when Iran fell to the Muslims. So you're talking the 7th century. So before the 7th century, Persia would have been essentially white. And then it was after the 7th century that these Muslims moved in there and basically changed the ethnicity. The same as they did in India. They got rid of the caste system in India when the Muslims went in there. So they're saying that they were the world's foremost military power at this time. And this was Sunni Islam, which today we have in Saudi Arabia. And then we have Shiite Islam, which is Afghanistan, I think, and Iran. And I think Shiite Islam goes back to one of Muslim's brothers. I mean, there was an argument after Muhammad. There was an argument about who was supposed to be the next person that was leading Islam, basically. So you had this one group here, Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman and Ali, and they're famous in Islam, and they're the ones that started off the Sunni Islam. And then you had this other branch, which was Shiite Islam, and then you have another branch, which is the whirling dervishes, which is the mystic Islam, the Sufi Muslims. So you've got three main branches. And I think the Sufis really started in Persia, because in Persia they added Zoroastrianism and other ideas that they had in Persia that sort of influenced the Islam that they had over there. So you end up with this mystic branch of Islam as well. Any thoughts on the Umayyad Caliphate or the early years of Islam, Trifids?
Yeah, I don't really know much about, Islam, but certainly this was basically the end of the East, right? The white people there, previous to that, prior to that, sorry, there were still, you know, Persians and Assyrians and Medes and remnants of, the Greeks who had moved there and the Parthian Empire. But all that was to end. And this is part of biblical prophecy, right, that he would, the Israelites migrated to Europe, but the rest of the world would be overrun. And also in Revelation, it tells us that a locust will come out of the pit and it would last 150 days. And a day is a year in prophecy. And the Islamic conquest lasted 150 years. And after that, they kind of run out of steam and started infighting. But then the second wave would come, but that would be the Turks a few centuries later, which would eventually overrun the Byzantine Empire, right?
It's amazing, isn't it? You know, straight after the advent of Muhammad, you've suddenly got this huge military power. I mean, and yet it's a religion. You know, it's not like Buddhism, you know, like essentially peaceful. You know, straight away, you've got this huge army that is then going out and conquering. And I guess at this time, you still had Kushites living in Ethiopia, you know, white people that were in Ethiopia and a lot of these countries. And then it was after this great wave of Arabs came in that all that ethnicity got changed to being partly Arabic, I guess. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
It was clearly spearheaded by doctrine, and you know, it was, I mean, what would the outcome was basically to nullify the gospel of Christianity, which in the sense that it, well, in the Christian theology, it's no one is chosen, God chooses who his people are, right? And it was, you know, kind of the opposite to that. They kind of choose who and whoever to convert. So, you know, I think it was definitely designed to attack Christianity and, you know, bring it down. And obviously to attack Christianity, you have to attack the people that brought it about or, you know, were kind of believing in it.
Yeah, that ties in with, you know, this Jewish influence as well. You know, because there was this conflict between Jews and Christianity. The Jews didn't like the way that they were being treated by the Christians, and the Christians didn't like the way that the Jews were responsible for usury. I mean, we'll see later on that in countries that Jews came into, I mean, in Britain, within, I think, about 100 years, you know, the greatest landowner in the country was a Jew because they'd been allowed to use this usury. So you had this conflict between the Christians, didn't like the Jews using their usury, and you had this conflict from the Jews against the Christians because at certain points, the Christians would then have a pogrom and they'd burn down where the houses that the Jews had, and they'd burn all their rolls and all their debts, and a lot of Jews would get killed. So you had this conflict between Jews and between Christians. So the Jews are then going to sponsor the Muslims because once the Muslims are taken over, the Jews were given this elevated position where they weren't hated so much by the general population. Of course, that's different today. And the reason for that is because you have all these problems in the Middle East. You have Palestine and you have this Jewish state of Israel that's in Palestine. And that's caused a lot of problems between Jews and Muslims. Whereas if you go back, you know, 1,000 years, Jews and Muslims were united. They were a united force. It's only today that there is this, you know, this big dislike by Muslims for Jews and a lot of anti-Semitism that comes from Muslims. You know, we often hear about it, but it all basically goes back to problems between Israel and the Palestinians. But before that, we didn't have these problems. Well, next we'll look at Odo the Great, and rather than making on a start that today, I think we'll probably finish here, unless either of you got some final thoughts on what we've been talking about today, Truefids.
Yeah, I think that Charles Martel would certainly be one of the great kings of Europe, right? Because he put his life on the line. He went against the church. He realized that, no, we have to stop them. As I said, he got a lot of flack for that. But in the end, he defended France and he basically defended Europe, right? If not France could have got overrun, and then it could have started reaching Germany and who knows what, right? And perhaps as a reward from God, his grandson ended up ruling basically all of Europe, right? Charlemagne. So it's interesting how it worked out, right?
Yeah, that became the Carolingian Empire, didn't it? So Charles Martel, he took the initiative and he saved the whole of Europe from Islamization, basically. Patriarch, any final thoughts?
Just that it just goes to show the importance of kindred nations staying together, and because it's when we're divided that we're taken advantage of, and it seems to be the same today as it was back then.
Yeah, it's when we have this external force that comes against us that, you know, it's time for us to all unite and forget our problems. Just the same as we were saying about the Cymry, that were paying the tax to the Saxons in London for the military defence of the island. You know, they were still squabbling with the Saxons, but if it came down to it and somebody was to invade, they would have all united to push back. And that's essentially what you had here, as we'll learn as we get into this, as this Islamic army came in, the Gauls had to unite amongst each other to push back against them, and that's what led to afterwards to the Carolingian Empire and the rule of Charlemagne the Great. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Truth Fits.
Thanks for having me, as always. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
Thanks, Sven. Thanks for the good episode. Cheers.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more patriotic history for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.